Hi, and welcome to episode 6 of the Future of Banking podcast. I'm your host, Kimberly Waldron from SkyParlor, and today we're going to be examining the world of consumer credit and taking a look at the new fintechs entering the market to improve consumer choice. I have three fantastic guests with me, all from different corners of the space. So a very warm welcome to Hannah Preston. Hannah is commercial strategist for retail and banking at MENA Technologies. MENA Technologies is a fintech focused on enabling consumers to consume products and services via a subscription model. I also have with me Greg Cox, who is the group CEO of Quint Group. Quint is an international fintech group focused on improving access to credit. It owns and operates a number of leading businesses in the consumer credit space, including Monevo, which is Europe's largest personal credit platform and marketplace. Finally, I have with me Mark Walker, who is the co-founder and COO of the Power 50. Power 50 is the annual guide to the most influential, innovative and powerful figures in fintech. Mark is also the editorial director of the Fintech Times, which is a multimedia news outlet and home to the first and still the only dedicated fintech newspaper. Welcome to everybody. I'm looking forward to hearing your thoughts on this subject.
So really pleased to have you all here. I think it would be great if we could go to Mark, having that overview of what's going on in fintech. And I know that you've just conducted an insights report to some of your members and contributed as to what's going on really with people at the moment. What are their concerns? Have they dealt well with the changes of the last 6 months? If you don't mind kicking us off with that, that'd be great.
Yeah, Kanda said, obviously, with the, you know, the FinTech Power 50, the 40 members that we've had since January, it's been quite interesting because obviously appointing the 40 companies, as I said, in January, and then getting to March when obviously everything changed. We did a little bit of research into trying to understand, you know, what they had started out thinking they would be doing in 2020, what they've ended up doing and what their thoughts are for the future. And I think some of the overwhelming sort of things with this is obviously the ability for companies within the fintech sector to be able to sort of pivot and change their various different models. There's been some really interesting sort of developments, especially in the sort of bank challenger sort of areas, with the likes of sort of like the Starling Bank, the Tides, and those sort of people, where the move to being involved in the lending process has been quite interesting. With a need for the whole industry to be supported through government delivered loans, etc. So the ability for those companies to react quickly, change their actual product offering, change the way that they're effectively propositioning their clients has been a really interesting one. And I think a lot of what's happened sort of in the last sort of months or two is actually then a focus moving away from obviously just the survival sort of thing and actually moving into trying to thrive in the new way of working. So a lot of different revenue models, I think, have been looked at, being adapted and being tried out to see whether that's the way to move forward with it. Obviously, the biggest thing from all of our research was really the concept of moving from, relying on VC funds into profitability. And that's a lot that we've seen in all areas of the press at the moment is obviously people in times of need start looking at companies and going, okay, before we were quite happy to, invest and think, yep, we're investing in the future and how new things are going to be. When money gets a little bit difficult, economies start shrinking, you start thinking, actually, do we need a bit more profitability? So that's probably one of the biggest trends that we've seen with a lot of our clients that were previously not that they were not profitable, but they were focusing much more on user acquisition and now starting to move into that focus on profitability and sustainable business models. And that's probably a subject that we'll probably speak a little bit more on going forward, I'd imagine, as well.
Yeah, and I have that without kind of not expecting you to name businesses, but in terms of kind of type of business or approach, have there been any big winners or losers, perhaps for want of a better phrase, so far?
Yeah, and I think, I mean, specifically one of my personal sort of interesting areas, having previously worked for, the UK government and the London Mayor's Office as well, has been the way that the government has stimulated or tried to stimulate or support the economy. And I think one of the biggest winners out of that, which I think I can name, would be Starling Bank, who very effectively pivoted their business model and very quickly got authorised to deliver the coronavirus business interruption loans and the bounce back loan schemes. And I think, you know, they saw a number of accounts opened grow massively through the roof because they were able to pivot their model and get those access to those loans quickly. That also came with major challenges as well, because of the way that the lending system has to be done. And, you know, my colleagues on the podcast will know this much better than me. You know, the way to actually lend money in a traditional incumbent bank is you use people's deposits, you use your investments, and you use that to that capital on your balance sheet to effectively back the loans. If you're a fintech company that doesn't have the vast capital reserves and doesn't hold on to deposits from clients and customers, where do you get the money to put into your balance sheet to justify and to substantiate the loans? Well, then you have to go and raise more funds. So I think with Starling particularly, although that's been a really, you'd say, you know, it's a pretty big positive for them to actually open new accounts and get more people tied to using their accounts, it's also come with a much bigger requirement to have a much more sort of open investor network, get more money into the business and actually have more on the balance sheet as well.
I think on the face of it, from an image point of view, that involvement with the government-supported loans has been great for the profile of fintechs and for the infrastructure and how they can deliver and sit alongside traditional financial services business. So, as you say, in the background, you know, it presented its challenges, but it's been a good image improver.
I think it's been very good for those at the forefront, like the Starlings. What it has not done very well for, I think, is the alternative finance market. And I think the biggest issue there was the government, it really unveiled a real lack of understanding from the government on what the alternative finance market was and how it could have helped. Because I think early on in the process, if the government and the Treasury had engaged more with that section of the market, money could have got out in a much more cleaner, efficient and straightforward way to the people that really needed it, rather than, you know, the weeks and weeks of turmoil that people went through waiting for replies from their incumbent banks and everything else. And the incumbent banks were waiting for the government to, you know, reduce restrictions, reduce some security measures and all this sort of stuff to enable them to lend and do things quickly, where actually the alternative financing sort of companies within fintech probably could have done that a lot quicker and a lot easier. But they weren't involved in the conversation. So I think it kind of showed a bit of a hole in the way that the government and the regulators look on the whole sort of lending market as well.
Yeah, and without going into a complete different conversation, it was a point touched on in a previous podcast that it's not tech, it's not regulation, it's the international global governments that are going to perhaps stifle the potential of fintechs or innovation. So I guess that's for another day, but it's interesting as well that you bring that point up about the lack of understanding even.
Yeah, and absolutely.
In
sort of contrast with what Mark was saying there about the incumbents, I work with the incumbent banks, and actually they've leveled up. You know, they've shocked themselves as to what can be achieved in the timescales that they've achieved it to, you know, to some people, weeks would have felt like a long time, but they were doing things in weeks that would have ordinarily taken years. So for them, you know, to be able to implement things as quickly as they did was a real surprise to them too. You know, it's amazing how things can get done when you have a very clear focus on the problem that you're trying to solve. And, you know, I think in some ways it was great for the banks to just be able to prove to themselves that things can happen quickly when they need to.
Yeah, I would agree with you on that. I mean, I would also say, having worked in government as well, I'm aware how slow government can work at times. And for the government to actually release, you know, a coronavirus business interruption loan scheme and a bounce back loan scheme through the British Business Bank in, you know, just under, I think, 6 weeks is unheard of. You know, that's revolutionary sort of speed. So I agree with you, and I'm not sort of bashing the banks or the government in that respect. But I think a learning from it would be is that if all areas of fintech have been involved a little bit sooner, then we could have even made it less than 6 weeks. It could have even been 3 weeks, 2 weeks, and that sort of stuff as well is more the sort of point. So less of this is what went wrong and we should start blaming people, more of these are things we should learn for, you know, as we may be going through another second wave now, these are things that we've learned from the first one, which we should perhaps take into account when we're starting looking at this situation or other, you know, large economic issues that, that will definitely come up in the future as well.
I guess that brings us nicely background to kind of the lending, the point on what's happening in the lending market at the moment, specifically the consumer lending. There's a lot of moving parts, a lot of internal and external influences at the moment. So perhaps Greg, as our expert in that space, you could kick us off with what's happening at the moment. What's the state of play? What's happening in consumer lending at the moment?
Yeah, sure. Be happy to. Obviously, just to sort of touch on what Mark said, there's been a hell of a lot of movement in the business lending space and SME lending space, and you know, COVID's definitely created opportunity within that, and that's the same in the US market too, where some businesses have probably been able to carry on going because of the ability to distribute that credit. You know, people like Funding Circle as well in the UK have done well out of some of these things. I think on the consumer side of things, it isn't all doom and gloom, but the consumer credit market in the UK is facing unprecedented challenges and has seen huge impact on it as a result of COVID-19. If you go back to April, when this really started to bite, there was a complete contraction in the supply of credit across all the markets we work across. We work with about 150 banks and lenders globally, and we saw about 95% of lenders stop lending completely during April. And that contraction in the supply of credit was also met with a huge contraction in the demand for personal credit too. I think on the demand side, it was really driven by consumers. Consumers borrow when they're confident, fundamentally, despite sort of, I think generally sometimes think of people are desperate for money, they borrow money. That's not true. People, when they're confident, take on debt because they think their jobs are secure and they're going to be able to repay that debt. And obviously consumer confidence was, you know, hugely impacted, and the supply of credit contracted for a whole bunch of reasons. But I guess fundamentally, lenders spend years and years building an understanding of who they should lend to for their particular business model. And that's, you know, that's done in a very complex and sophisticated way these days. And what COVID really did was take all those pieces that all the lenders have been putting together for the last however many years, throw them all up in the air, and they all landed on the floor in front of them. And all of a sudden, lenders were faced with, who should we lend to? Should we lend to somebody in the airline industry? Should we lend to somebody in travel? Should we lend to somebody that's on furlough? How do we know whether somebody on furlough is going to come back to their job? How do we know whether they're going to be made redundant? So a huge set of challenges for lenders. And what we've seen post that is lenders start to understand how to navigate what's a very, very difficult landscape for them. And you know, if you fast forward to today, we started to see that supply of credit loosen up month on month, but it's still well below pre-pandemic levels, and accessing credit in the UK is much harder than it was pre-COVID. Lenders have also got capital issues. A lot of them have given payment holidays to customers, which has been mandated by the FCA. Payment holiday obviously means that they lose a lot of the receipts they're receiving every month. So there's big holes in their cash flows that they weren't necessarily expecting to be there. So I think where lenders are now is they're very keen to get back lending. Obviously, all lenders, whether they're banks or online lenders or alternative lenders, all want to be serving their customers, and they're just understanding what's the best way to do it. And at the moment, they're all looking very cautiously at what the next 2-3 months looks like as the government furlough schemes and other sort of support schemes come to an end, and then how that translates into potential defaults within their lending books. So it's recovering slowly. We're seeing it across all territories that we operate in: Poland, Australia, the US, and the UK. And about 90% of lenders are back in market at the moment lending, but at much lower levels. And it's also worth commenting that customers are paying higher rates as a result of COVID. So interest rates have gone down. Obviously, as we know, and we're talking about negative interest rates, but across the board, lenders are charging more money to higher interest rates to customers as they price more potential risk into their models, and ultimately there's less competition as well in the market for customers. That's the kind of negative end of life and the kind of COVID impact. What we're seeing in the neobank space, you know, which is interesting, is neobanks, as Mark alluded to, coming under pressure to better deliver revenues. And if you look at what banks, you know, if you Google what is a bank, it basically says an institution that takes deposits and lends money, simplistically. And a lot of the neobanks have been providing current accounts, taking deposits, and not lending, certainly on the consumer credit side, a great deal of money. And you know, what we've seen over the last kind of 12, 24 months is those lenders starting to try and get their personal lending businesses off of the ground. People like Monzo and Starling have come to market with personal loans. But I think that progress has been has definitely obviously faced the same set of challenges that all the other, you know, incumbent lenders have faced. And I think those banks are probably finding it hard to continue to progress that at a time when they probably really do need to, you know, progress growing revenues from, you know, from their lending activity. We're also seeing banks using fintech partnerships with business like one of our businesses, Monevo, to power personal loan solutions via other lenders in the marketplace. And we're seeing that with big banks as well that we're speaking to. So where lenders can't lend to a customer, they're looking at providing alternative lending solutions via platforms like ours to give customers better choice and better outcomes. And obviously, if they haven't got lending products in market themselves, they're trying to service that demand for lending. Because I think ultimately, my view is that, you know, for these neobanks to be truly successful, they have to be able to provide on the business side all of the different business services, including, you know, lending on the business side. And it's same for the credit side. People want a bank that can not only provide them with a brilliant current account, they want an overdraft, they want credit cards, they want, you know, they want loans. So it'll be very interesting to see over the next sort of 6 to 12 months whether the neobanks really are able to continue to build momentum on the consumer credit side of their businesses, and also to see whether the kind of mainstream banks and indeed the incumbent lenders start to lend a bit more. I think
I was going to say, just dipping quickly onto that comment, because that's a really interesting bugbear of mine that you sort of mentioned there, which is regards to the neobanks and starting lending. It's kind of like the definition of the word bank, which certain people in the market don't like, people like Revolut and that calling themselves banks because of the exact reason that you just mentioned. But do you not think that for innovative, you know, forward-thinking, technologically advanced companies, they shouldn't be trying to replicate an incumbent bank, which it sounds like effectively what they're trying to do? They're effectively using the same revenue generation models that have been tried and tested by a bank for, you know, 50 years. Wouldn't it be nicer if these bank challengers actually came up with a new revenue challenge that didn't revolve on holding deposits and didn't revolve on having to lend? I just kind of think that, is there any point in disassembling a bank to then recreate it, but just in exactly the same model?
And there lies the opportunity for a subscription model, right? This is what we're talking about, is a totally new, you know, it's not going to completely replace consumer lending or, you know, credit cards or loans or whatever. But, you know, customers don't think, I want a credit card or I want a loan. They just want stuff. They want stuff in the most convenient and flexible way possible. And I think with COVID and the impact of that, you know, people more than ever want flexibility, because literally overnight everything changed. You know, like, you know, I've got a car, I don't need two cars now. So yeah, and I'm left with this car that I now need to sort of figure out how I get rid of it without incurring a huge cost for negative equity. I don't particularly like, I just want a car. I don't want a car loan. I want to have what I need when I need it. And I want the flexibility to be able to, you know, scale up or scale down depending on my lifestyle. And I think the challenger bank, the neobanks, really understand like what the customer needs and what the customer wants. And I think that they will start to serve that market in a very different way. And subscriptions are a really interesting way to do that, an alternative to sort of more traditional financial products.
I guess perhaps while we've come onto that subject then, Hannah, how do they differ from kind of point of sale financing options like Klarna or Divide By? How does the subscription model differ?
the big difference is ownership versus sharing or kind of renting. So you don't tend to, you know, if I subscribe to a car, so Volvo have got a subscription model where you can pay a certain amount per month, and it's like a product as a service. So it comes with everything. You know, you don't have to worry about tires, you don't have to worry about servicing, you don't have to worry about anything. If your car breaks down, you get a new car, you get another car. Now, I, you know, in terms of subscribing to that Volvo, I don't necessarily get a new Volvo. I never own that Volvo. That Volvo will, you know, it will be whatever I need. So if I needed to scale up to a bigger vehicle, then I could just hand back that car that I've got currently and get the bigger model and, you know, increase my subscription sort of payment, if you like. And I looked at it because I have a Volvo and I just mentioned my car situation, whereby I looked at the cost over like 3-5 years versus me owning that vehicle versus subscribing based on the prices that Volvo have indicated that you'd be able to subscribe to. And it works out there or thereabouts. It's about the same. You know, if you take into consideration depreciation, the cost of maintenance and all that sort of stuff, then I'm no worse off. But where I would have been better off is that a year ago, I didn't need that second car. So at that point, I could save myself maybe £7,000 and handed it back and said, thank you very much. You know, it's that, it's a bit like, you know, it's that lack of commitment. You don't need to commit to 3 to 5 years. You know, you're just sort of like, you know, I need this, maybe furniture packs. You know, we recently, Mina rented an apartment in London and we just rented the whole all the furniture. So, you know, paid monthly for everything, included forks, knives, everything that you can imagine that you would need to operate in this flat, lamps, beds, whatever. And at the end of that tenancy, we just hand it back. You know, we subscribe to that stuff as long as we need it. And at the point when we don't need it anymore, we just give it back. Me and my husband argue a lot about these things, where he loves to have things. So he's got a massive CD collection and he's got, you know, he likes his stuff. And I'm a real minimalist. It's like stuff for me just feels like a drag. You know, it doesn't give me the ability to change and flex up or flex down. And, you know, then you get stuck with this stuff and it's like, oh, and now I need to sell this thing. And, you know, it's just hassle to me. So, you know, subscribing to things makes more sense. Like this year, for instance, everybody's been camping and kayaking and whatever because they haven't been able to go on holiday. And do you really want to be stuck with the tent and the kayak? And, you know, wouldn't it be great if you could just like hire it for a year and have everything you need and then just hand it all back at the end of it? And so it's really that difference between owning something and subscribing. I mean, my CEO, COO, sorry, would like to subscribe to clothes. I draw the line at that, but, you know, why not? You know, instead of having a wardrobe full of stuff and only wearing 10, 20% of it, you know, once I'm done with it, I just send it back. But it would be more curated. So you would have like, you subscribe to a wardrobe and then each quarter, each season, you'll get, you know, a capsule of stuff and the capsule goes back, they launder it. And, you know, and it's just a completely different way of consuming the things that you need. And then once you're sort of done with those things, you don't have to hang on to those things. You can just sort of hand them back or whatever.
It's interesting that you touch on a couple of things and I guess demanding specific sectors as well that are very topical, like the DIY home improvement went through the roof in the first 3 months of COVID. I think 20% or something B&Q saw an increase. So it is that idea of consumer behavior and circumstance changing how they want to acquire goods, as you're saying, as they want to purchase. And do you think that there's still an education process that will need to happen there, or do you think that this is really being driven by what consumers want?
I think it's platforms like Mina that are going to power this new market. You know, there has to be trust, there has to be transparency, there has to be the ability to discover these things easily and to be able to have, you know, fairness. And you know, what would kill this whole thing is if, you know, you have merchants that then sort of, you know, a bit like the Blockbuster days where you end up with fees and charges that you didn't sign up for. Yeah, it needs to be transparent. And so, you know, what Mina's doing is actually creating that new channel within the bank's environment. So we integrate into the bank's app and then consumers can manage all of their subscriptions in the app. So that means they can see what they're paying for, they can cancel things, and they can discover new subscription products, services, things like that. So there may be like learning, there may be, you know, household, there may be travel, there may be, you know, why not, you know, why can't a plane be like a train? Why can't I pay £600 a month or something and have unlimited flights to Sweden, you know, one route, and have that model? I understand, like, on a train, if you go on the day, you pay more or whatever, but I can still buy a monthly ticket that allows me to do what I need to do. And it's things like that. And so if people are able to discover things that add value to their life through a trusted channel, and the bank would be that, with a platform that makes everything transparent, easy and simple, then I think that's where we end up with this new economy.
I was going to say, it's kind of interesting. I think as you've sort of pointed out, trust is the real key in there, because I think the really interesting thing about sort of the concept of borrowing money is that it's probably the only thing that consumers kind of relate having to pay a fee for doing it to. It's kind of like when you look at everything else, you know, when you have a current account, you don't pay for your current account. And that's something that the neobanks have been really struggling to try and get people to pay for the privilege of having a current account, because the banks for so many years were, you know, you don't charge for the current account, you charge for all the other stuff. And they sort of ingrained in us this idea that when you borrow money, you have to pay for the privilege of borrowing it. So would you say that that's like a limitation in the subscription model, where people are just going to assume they're going to pay more for it? Because they think, well, it can't be right that, you know, I'm getting to pay this on a subscription basis and it's actually costing me the same amount as if I would just put, you know, the full cash down first of all.
I think the difference is the value. Like, you know, say that example I gave you of subscribing to furniture, what you're actually paying for is a curated kind of furniture pack that is like, you know, a designer's put together, like Stitch Fix, for instance. You're paying for that personal shopper, right? And you're not buying clothes then, you're buying a lifestyle. You're sort of like telling this personal shopper, I've got this event coming up and they've got this, that and the other, and they'll accessorize you and help you look the way that you want to. And I think it's more around that. So that, you know, there's always going to be people that want to like buy things at a certain price and own those things and have those things forever. And then there's other people that are just like, you know, I want experiences, I want my lifestyle to change, and I want to be able to consume things in my own way. And they don't look at things in that same cost model. They're looking at it from a slightly different lens.
I think the car analogy you used, Hannah, is a great example of this. You know, and kind of, if you look at owning a car, if you're buying it through, you know, taking out hire purchase or a loan, you're as a consumer, you're having to choose the right car, you're having to manage depreciation, which none of us are professionals at. In terms of a car, we buy a car because we like it and it looks nice. We don't buy it because we know whether its future value is going to be higher or lower than the other car sat next to it. We take on the risk of negative equity, like you said. We take on kind of mechanical risk too. We have a really long-term commitment for a car too, generally, you know, 3 years. And I think what we've seen with the rise of PCP, which is kind of the closest thing we've had to subscription, which has had a huge sort of, huge growth over the last few years, is people, in terms of a car, it's a commodity for most people. We want to buy a car. I think most people would like to understand, what does it cost me every month? I've not got this risk and worry about when I come to sell it, I've all of a sudden become a car dealer, or I've got to take it back to a car dealer and get a price for it. And I don't know whether that's a fair price or not. And, oh, can I get out of my finance agreement? And is that ultimately, you know, affecting my set of choices? And I think that, you know, that car example you use is a great way, where I think most people would just not want to have all those stresses and go, I want to pay £500 a month. I get a Volvo or whatever car you want. I've got everything included within that. I haven't got to worry about it. And I know in 3 years' time, I'm not going to have a financial, you know, a debt that I didn't expect to have, or I was going to have a problem getting rid of this car. And then if you can add in the flexibility of switching out of products and stuff too, I think, you know, in the modern world, that's what, you know, that's what people want. Obviously, I think it's applicable clearly to lots of different things like furniture. I'd never thought about, but it sounds like a really interesting space.
I think as well, when we spoke, Hannah, before today, we mentioned that you mentioned that idea of sustainability and that being a global mission. And it's kind of an example of creating that more, blurring those lines, the more intimate relationship between the retailer and the consumer and the bank and the retailer, and us all working together on that kind of citizenship program to be better people. Not to quote the recent David Attenborough Extinction Program, but it is an opportunity for financial services to be part of that, isn't it?
I think it's a really good opportunity for merchants, consumers, and the banks to play a big part in sustainability. It's interesting actually, because yesterday when I mentioned to my husband that I'd be on this podcast, and he said, "What are you talking about?" And I said, "Well, subscriptions and reusability and having things on subscription." And he's like, "You're just going to drive consumerism." I was like, "No, that's not what we're trying to do here." I was thinking about the camping thing. Like, imagine go outdoors. I love camping, and it's one of my guilty pleasures anyway. But I buy a tent, and then the poles break, right? And then I can't buy the poles to fix the tent. But go outdoors or somewhere like that, they've got all the stock. They could recondition that tent and then send it back out again. And for a lot of people, like, these days in modern houses, people don't have garages, they don't have a lot of storage. So then you're stuck with all of this stuff. Wouldn't it be great if, and also, one year you might be camping with four of you, and next year you're like, "Hey, should we take the whole family and we'll have like 10-man tent or whatever?" So, being able to then go, right, okay, well, this summer, we're going to have, we're just going to, hire what we need effectively. And so organizations, maybe they can have two types of models. One where they're selling stuff to people that want to buy it, and two, they offer a subscription whereby, you can have it for as long as you want it, and then you just pay monthly, and at the point when you finish with it, you hand it back, and we can cover any damage and things like that with insurance, and then we've got a bit of a systems in place to then recondition things. It's like with the car, my husband's like, "Well, if I'm sharing cars with people, I don't know how they're going to look after things." My view is like, I don't really care, as long as they come to me and they're clean, and the company that manages that service makes sure that is up to scratch. I don't care who's had it before. I don't care if they drive fast and hit the brakes, as long as the brake pads have been replaced. Do you know what I mean? So I think that it would be awesome if we could, instead of throwing away our laptops, instead of throwing away micros, instead of throwing away stuff, we could reuse it, and we can recondition stuff, and then offer it to people at a sort of rate that a monthly cost that makes sense to them. Because when you're sort of you move into your new house or whatever, you're young, and the outlay of having to buy everything up front, take on all these debts, and you're trying to find your feet with your work and things like that can change as well. So it's really uncertain in the early sort of my 20s to 30s came with lots of uncertainty, whereas now I'm sort of a bit more stable. But and then sometimes you don't know whether your job will require you to move to a different country potentially, and you're stuck with all this stuff, and it could be valuable to someone else. So I think that we could, if we were able to create this reusable economy, then we would maybe avoid, throwing away stuff that could be really valuable to someone else.
I think it's important there that you mentioned it's that life cycle, and that the fintech market is delivering to consumers and businesses at different stages of their life cycle with products that suit them and are most appropriate. And I think I've got a bit of a mouthful of a question for Greg now, kind of bringing it back to something you said about needing to get the consumer lending market back to where the appetite to lend and the desire to borrow kind of marries up and matches in the market. And I think what I wanted to ask you was, where does innovation sit with that? And is there room for more innovation to help with recovery? And where do investors sit with that? Because you've been 11 years or so in this space, so you've seen the recovery from another catastrophic event, we could call it. So what do we need to do to get back?
Look, I think at a headline level, people, we need to get some consistency and some stability, you know, from an economic perspective, and understand, you know, which direction we're trending. I think there's quite a lot of unknowns at the moment. So over time, as we start to come out of the pandemic and we understand what the, you know, the landscape and the future looks like, I think that will give lenders more comfort to open up, you know, the supply of credit to make sure that people can access it. And it's ultimately a key driver of the economy. People obviously borrow money to do lots of different things. As Hannah said, they don't go and get a loan, really. They're going and getting a car, and the loans just facilitate that. I think innovation, you know, is COVID has definitely driven some innovation that we're seeing. So things like the use of open banking data is something that we've done a huge piece of work on, to get open banking data integrated into our platform. And we did that about 6 to 12 months sooner than we would have done. And that's true for a lot of lenders, because again, can we use open banking data to make smarter decisions about customers and financially include more customers by understanding, you know, more about them, and whether, you know, actually, yeah, but, you know, while they have asked for a payment holiday, their finances remain stable through this period, or people that are new to country, can we help facilitate lending to them? So I definitely think when you have change and challenges like this, it sharpens the mind, and there's a lot of innovation, a big drive in innovation for people to be able to understand how they can navigate through this period and come out of it stronger on the other side of things. Innovation costs money too, as well. And I think obviously the investment community is a lot more cautious than it was pre-COVID. There was a huge amount of investment into fintech generally and into the consumer credit space. And I think consumer credit in investors' eyes now is an area they're particularly nervous of. You know, if you're sat there looking to invest in a credit business, for somebody to sit down in front of an investor and say, look, we want to lend money to customers in this way, and we're confident about how they're going to repay, is much harder than it was pre-COVID. So I think, yes, there's lots of innovation, and I think everybody is innovating and doing everything they can to free up that supply of credit and start lending again. But at the same time, the investment required to do that in some cases, I think, is going to be harder to get hold of. And we've seen that with at a broader level with the neobanks and some of the other fintechs. I read an interesting article actually earlier on this week that said that's more acute in Europe and the UK than it is in the US. I think there's been about 30% reduction in VC funding in the UK and Europe versus, I think it was about 15%, you know, reduction in the US. So there's clearly more caution around the European market versus the US market at the moment. Hopefully that sort of goes some way to answering your question.
It does. Yes, I was on mute. Excuse me. It does. Yes. Thanks, Greg. And I think I can then come to Mark to ask the question. Do you think you'll see a slight change in the shape maybe of your membership at the Power 50 as that the funding for the lending market or lending fintechs and digital banks kind of changes and the market deals with that?
Yeah, I think we are definitely seeing a change in that a lot more, as sort of Greg alluded to. The traditional way of assessing somebody's credit worthiness has been flawed for many, many years. And I think the opportunity to innovate in that space with all of the additional sort of RegTech, KYC, AML, and all these other innovations that are coming forward is what we're really seeing. I think I don't know, it wasn't necessarily COVID that triggered it, but I think even at the beginning of 2020, identity was going to become a really big topic. And as we moved into the COVID sort of phase, the sort of the way that people can, one, prove who they are, but also how people assess their credit worthiness started to sort of come much closer together. And what we're already seeing is a lot more of our members focusing on that end of the market. And a lot of the people that are, you know, looking into moving into the lending space are actually not necessarily looking to move into the traditional, you know, we're going to raise some money and lend it out. They're looking at actually ways that they can actually support people better to assess their credit worthiness. And I think that's really going to be something that's going to carry on and hopefully stay with us into 2021. You know, the age old days of, you know, when you used to go for a mortgage and you say, right, it's three times your salary. And that's it. You know, we don't need to know any more than that. As long as you've got a job and we'll take your salary, three pay slips and away you go. Especially in these COVID times where people have been furloughed and various other things, and Greg said it earlier, you know, that we need a new method to assess whether these, you know, the risks are mitigated in certain circumstances or not. So I definitely see that as one of the major things moving forwards.
So perhaps
I think just to add to what Mark, just to add to what Mark said, I think the lenders and the credit businesses that get that right have really got an opportunity to make a big jump now ahead of their competitor set. And I think some will get it right and some won't get it right. And I think, you know, that's where COVID will, you know, does present a lot of opportunity in this space. It's created the kind of forum and the playing field to really push, you know, these types of innovations and changing the way we do things. And I think those that, that get it right have got a fantastic opportunity in front of them.
Something it's quite interesting, a trend in the UK sort of relates to like the topic that I'm covering, is that so they did some research and they found that people are less likely to default on a subscription agreement than they are on a loan agreement. I guess because of the flexibility that's built into a subscription model, that you don't have to sort of like try and figure out how you honor that commitment. You can just get out of that commitment. And then, you know, and so what's happening in the US is actually merchants are back to backing their subscriptions with finance. So instead of, you know, the consumer having to go and figure out how they buy that Apple Mac or whatever, Apple decide, you know, who they want to sign up to their Apple Macs, and then they take on that liability and then back to back that subscription. But it's easier for Apple to sort of, you know, be able to do something with that device, and rather than, you know, you have an Apple Mac, you take a loan, and then, you know, the device isn't really worth repossessing at that point, and do you track that person down? And, you know, whereas with that sort of subscription type thing, the consumer, if they can't afford it anymore, they hand it back, and then Apple can then just sort of recondition it and put it back out there. But they are then back to backing those subscription agreements. It's creating a new financial sector, you know, a new opportunity really to sort of change the model, instead of, you know, lenders lending to the person, the purchaser, they're lending to the company that then, you know, making those products available to those consumers in a more flexible and simpler way.
I think there's definitely a convergence, isn't there, between the kind of point of sale, and people are starting to call it, you know, point of sale, or embedded finance is another term that, you know, that's being used a lot. And I think you've got people like Klarna, obviously, that, you know, from a regulated perspective, aren't provided regulated lending products, but they're allowing people to pay, over time, and obviously they're essentially collecting their interest from the merchants on a lot of their products. You've obviously got subscription products like, you know, that yourselves are supporting, and people like Apple that are really taking a lending product, combining that with another product, and then they've created this subscription product. There's still inherent credit risk in all of that, but they're delivering it in a way that's more palatable to their consumers and customer bases. And I think that's where we'll see innovation. Ultimately, we need to serve customers in the way they want to be served. And customers want to be able to consume things in the way they want to be able to consume them. And I think, you know, we've seen a huge move over the last 2 to 3 years in those kind of areas. And it'll be interesting to see how that develops. I think lending, you know, I think it's the oldest business that's out there, so it'll always remain. But I think the form that it takes is clearly changing as consumers in this day and age want to consume things and buy things differently.
The other thing is it broadens their customer base. So, you know, if you think about it, sort of like who qualifies for a credit card, or who qualifies for a personal loan and things like that. One, it relies on you having some credit already. So that's sort of like, you know, a younger population that are out of that niche. Then there's people that have had, you know, things go wrong that then, you know, the current system is very unforgiving if you have points in your life that mean that you suffer some kind of financial hardship. My father's been bankrupt like 5 times or something, so like I've experienced how, you know, money can come and go and how those things can impact families and things like that. And so, you know, I think, you know, for merchants, they just want to distribute as much product as they can to as many people as they can. And I think that it's really amazing right now that, you know, I personally think that the whole the whole model, like lending and the whole credit sort of process was broken anyway and didn't support a new modern economy and people's lifestyles. You know, it relies on you having a permanent job. It relies on you having, you know, ticking all these boxes. And life now is so, you know, there's so many different ways to make a living and so many different formats, and there's a whole gig economy, and there's like, you know, there's, and yeah, I think that having something that gives access to more people is a really good thing, and if COVID is the catalyst for that, then yeah, then that's the silver lining in it all.
I guess what's happening is that. Sorry, go on.
No, just I think what's important, and obviously, and what we're trying to do in terms of our mission at Monevo, is centralize access to all those products so that customers actually get true choice about what's available to them. And I think the neobanks have a role to play in that. And I think, you know, nirvana is when a customer wants to borrow money or wants to buy something, they get to see all the options that are available to them through a single search, so they can truly get choice and they don't end up paying more than they should do for a loan or more than they should do via a subscription product, and they ultimately get what's right for them and best possible value. And I think that really is something that fintech, you know, that's a role that fintech can play in terms of providing that ultimate transparency, trust, so that when somebody takes out credit or buys something through a subscription service, they know they're getting the best possible deal and it's going to, you know, impact their lives as positively as possible with as few negatives as possible.
And I think that perhaps starts to bring us to a couple of closing questions, because as you say, COVID's kind of given us all on a personal and in a professional level an opportunity to reflect on a bit of a shared ideology, maybe. I don't know if I'm being too broad with that, but it's interesting to look at as where fintech's role is in that, and as the custodians of the safe and secure movement of money or transfer of value and funds, it's got to be a big one. We've clearly got a big role to play, and I think I've got a couple of closing questions. And one is that, you know, in 5 years' time, what will be the biggest adjustments that we see in this space now? I guess in the lending and credit general sphere, what do you think will be the legacy of COVID for this space? I'll come to Greg. I'll come to you first with that one. If you have a second to think.
Look, I think what will be the legacy of COVID? Well, look, I think if you go for fast forward in 5 years, I think there will be more regulation around financial products in most markets. I think that's inevitable. I hope that regulation's positive. I hope we're going to have a lot more financial inclusion. People can have better access to credit. There's about 5 million people in the UK with thin credit files that are essentially excluded from accessing, you know, credit and other products. And I hope that we'll be looking at a much bigger set of data to make decisions about people as people, whether we're looking at how people have paid subscriptions historically in 5 years, in addition to credit bureau data and banking data. I don't know, but yeah, certainly hopeful for more financial inclusion, better access to credit, and some, you know, great regulation to provide a safe sort of transparent framework for everybody.
That would be great. Hannah?
Very similar to what Greg is hoping for. Financial inclusion is a big thing for me. I think that if that was an outcome, you know, where we give greater access to more people, we serve market, you know, demographics of people that don't fit the current model, I think that would be fantastic. I think that what we will see is banks, and this includes both the traditional banks and neobanks, you know, where finances and lifestyle are less sort of separate. You know, they sort of look at your financial life more holistically and help you in lots of areas, like help you get cheaper electric, help you to, you know, coach you and help you to sort of be more financially well, or you know, in a better situation. And I think that's what we'll see more of as because of the rise in digital. You know, it means now that banks have more focus on that, and so that, I think that'll be a good thing.
And Mark, in terms of the shape of the industry, do you think we'll see, because of these things, as we're working towards that future, will we see more startups, more consolidation, or more collaboration between existing fintechs and lenders?
Yeah, I think we're going to see more and more of you know, sort of the ecosystem hopefully coming together, like a convergence of lots of different players within it. in an ideal world, what I'd like to see is that there is a continual mix of large companies, medium companies, small companies, because each of that sort of size of company and that sort of has innovation in a different way. And I think to sort of look at it as a future where, you know, there's a lot of talk of one super app to rule everything. I'm not a massive fan of one place to go for everything, because I think that inherently leads to monopolies and leads to less choice. What I'd like to see is much more transparency. I think both of my colleagues, Hannah and Greg, both mentioned that. Transparency, I really think, is the key for the fintech sector going forward. I think we have a real duty of care to actually open things up and let people see what they're actually doing and present it to them in a transparent and open way and let them make the choice of which way they want to go. And what I'd like to see is all factors of fintech, from the incumbent banks, the regulators and everyone, be working towards that. It's a bit of an utopian sort of future idea, but you know, I think that's perfectly achievable. And I think the fintech industry has the ability to really do that.
Yeah. And I think perhaps that's a good place to leave it with any final comments that anybody wants to make. We seem to have mapped out a better future there, incorporating more sustainable ways to finance consumers and how they want to purchase. So I think that's a good place to end the discussion, unless anybody's got any final comments or burning points that we didn't go over. Really enjoyed that. I think it was a great discussion. So thank you to all three of you.
No worries. Thank you for having us.
Thanks very much, Kimberly.
Mark, Greg.
Well, I certainly think that's a subject that's going to continue to play out in the very near future and also in the longer term, especially as we all, as consumers and as, I guess, people in the fintech space, continue to adapt to the economic and social changes happening around us. But for now, thank you again to my guests, Hannah, Greg and Mark. I've been your host, Kimberly Waldron. This is the episode 6 of the Future of Banking podcast. For more information on any of our guests or upcoming episodes, please visit futureofbanking.info/podcast. Thanks for joining us.